Pacifica Radio presents This Was a Man. Today, the second program in a five-part dramatic documentary on the life of William Shakespeare. Yesterday, we presented a brief sketch of the playwright. We now retrace our steps for an expanded study of the early years of Shakespeare's life.
The first questions about the unknown years in Shakespeare's life are when and why he left Stratford. One can take his pick from among the many answers that have been offered. Nicholas Rowe introduced into his biography a detailed account of a deer-stealing incident.
He had, by misfortune, common enough to young fellows, fallen into ill company, and amongst them, some that made a frequent practice of deer-stealing engaged him with them more than once in robbing a park that belonged to Sir Thomas Lucy of Charlecote, near Stratford. For this he was prosecuted by that gentleman, as he thought, somewhat too severely, and in order to revenge that ill usage he made a ballad upon him. And though this, probably the first essay of his poetry, be lost, yet it is said to have been so very bitter that it redoubled the prosecution against him to that degree that he was obliged to leave his business and family in Warwickshire for some time and shelter himself in London. In The Merry Wives of Windsor he made him, Falstaff, a deer-stealer, that he might at the same time remember his Warwickshire prosecutor under the name of Justice Shallow. He has given him very near the same coat of arms which Dugdale, in his Antiquities of that county, describes for a family there, and makes a Welsh parson descant very pleasantly upon him.
Rowe's account has the independent confirmation of some earlier jottings by a Richard Davies, rector of Sapperton in Gloucestershire. These jottings can be placed in time between 1688 and 1708.
William Shakespeare was born at Stratford-upon-Avon in Warwickshire about 1563 to 1564, much given to all unluckiness in stealing venison and rabbits, particularly from Sir Lucy, who had him oft whipped and then sometimes imprisoned, and at last made him fly his native country to his great advancement. But his revenge was so great that he is his Justice Clodbate, and calls him a great man, and that in allusion to his name bore three louses rampant for his arms.
Shakespeare went to London from Stratford sometime between the middle of 1584 and 1592. Perhaps he was driven away by Lucy's persecution. Acceptance of the deer-stealing story usually results in assigning an early date to the departure, since the deer-stealing exploit suggests the wildness of youth. Perhaps he was stifled by his own environment, both at home and at work, and left to broaden his horizon. Perhaps he went directly to London, and perhaps he made several prolonged stops along the way. The fact that the issue of the marriage terminated with the birth of twins suggests a date of departure not much later than 1585, but even this inference is shaky because of the relatively short distance between London and Stratford. Perhaps his decision to leave was the direct result of the visit of the company of actors to Stratford in 1586 and 87.
The second broad area of questioning concerning the blank years in Shakespeare's life deals with the activities that occupied his time during these years. John Aubrey's sketch of 1681 includes this intriguing passage.
Though, as Ben Jonson says of him, that he had but little Latin and less Greek, he understood Latin pretty well, for he had been in his younger years a schoolmaster in the country.
Now, it is perhaps unfortunately true that a great many of the commentators upon Shakespeare are schoolmasters of one sort or another, and so Aubrey's assertion has gained a favorable response from those who would like to believe that Shakespeare was a colleague. If it is true that Shakespeare taught school in his younger years, then it would be reasonable to assign his teaching to a period between 1584 and 1592. There is, however, conflicting testimony from Aubrey himself.
This William, being inclined naturally to poetry and acting, came to London, I guess, about 18, and was an actor at one of the playhouses, and did act exceedingly well.
At this point in his narrative, Aubrey seems to indicate that Shakespeare moved directly from calf-killing and butchery to the profession of acting, leaving no space for the school teaching mentioned later in the sketch. The 1693 letter of Mr. Dowdall, which contains hearsay evidence that Shakespeare had run from his master to London, offers this.
And there was received into the playhouse as a servitor, and by this means had an opportunity to be what he afterwards proved.
The account by Nicholas Rowe in 1709 expands a bit upon the discussions in Aubrey and Dowdall.
It is at this time and upon this accident that he is said to have made his first acquaintance in the playhouse. He was received into the company then in being, at first in a very mean rank, but his admirable wit, and the natural turn of it to the stage, soon distinguished him, if not as an extraordinary actor, yet as an excellent writer.
There is one notable distinction between the account of Aubrey and the accounts by Dowdall and Rowe. Aubrey has Shakespeare going to London with a view toward a career in the theatre, while Dowdall and Rowe present a running youth falling into a theatrical career quite by accident.
Beginning in 1748, or 132 years after the death of Shakespeare, there are elaborate accounts of the poet's early connection with the London theatre. A manuscript note, preserved in the University Library, Edinburgh, and written about 1748, tells a story about Shakespeare that it describes to Sir William Davenant, the 17th-century poet and dramatist who, it seems, fostered the rumor that he was Shakespeare's illegitimate son. The story goes this way.
Sir William Davenant, who's been called a natural son of our author, used to tell the following whimsical story of him. Shakespeare, when he first came from the country to the playhouse, was not admitted to act, but as it was then the custom for all the people of fashion to come on horseback to entertainments of all kinds, it was Shakespeare's employment for a time, with several other poor boys belonging to the company, to hold the horses and take care of them during the representation. By his dexterity and care, he soon got a good deal of business in this way, and was personally known to most of the quality that frequented the house, insomuch that, being obliged, before he was taken into a higher and more honourable employment within doors, to train up boys to assist him, it became long afterwards a usual way among them to recommend themselves by saying that they were Shakespeare's boys.
The story of horse-holding by Shakespeare and his boys appeared in print frequently thereafter.
Dr. Samuel Johnson repeats the story in his edition of The Works of Shakespeare, 1765. Dr. Johnson reports that the story came from Pope, who heard it from Rowe. Johnson adds the note that horse-holding was Shakespeare's first employment in London following his flight from the terror of a criminal prosecution.
Edmund Malone, the scholar who produced the two-volume supplement to the edition of Shakespeare's plays published in 1778 by Samuel Johnson and George Stevens in 1780, reports a tradition concerning Shakespeare's first activities within the theater.
There is a stage tradition that his first office in the theater was that of call boy, or prompter's attendant, whose employment it is to give the performers notice to be ready to enter as often as the business of the play requires their appearance on the stage.
In September 1592, Robert Greene, who had been educated at Cambridge and was one of the university wits, whose pens once dominated the London stage, lay dying in the house of a poor cobbler. Ravaged by pain and bitterness, Green wrote at this time Green's Groat's Worth of Wit, addressed to those gentlemen whose quondam acquaintance that spend their wits in making plays. It is addressed to other playwrights with university backgrounds, Marlowe and two others, probably Peel and either Nash or Lodge. Green violently attacks the companies of actors who have used his talents and have now deserted him. He warns his friends that a similar fate awaits them, for the actors are now able to use the services of a writer from among their own ranks.
Yea, trust them not, for there is an upstart crow beautified with our feathers, that with his tiger's heart wrapped in a player's hide, supposes he is as well able to bombast out a blank's verse as the best of you. And being an absolute Johannes factotum, in his own conceit, the only Shake scene in the country.
Tiger's Heart Wrapped in a Player's Hide is a parody of a line in Part 3 of Henry VI, O Tiger's Heart Wrapped in a Woman's Hide. There can be very little doubt that the upstart crow is William Shakespeare, particularly since the phrase, the only Shake scene in a country, is said by Greene to be in his own conceit. Henry Chettle, who prepared Greene's work for the press, felt the need to make something of an apology for parts of it in his own Kind Heart's Dream, registered in December of 1592. Chettle observes that one or two of the playmakers attacked by Greene have taken Greene's remarks offensively. Chettle says that he did not know these men when he worked on Greene's Groat's Worth of Wit, and that he does not desire to know one of them. He now regrets, however, that he did not change the reference to the other.
That I did not, I am as sorry as if the original fault had been my fault, because myself have seen his demeanour no less civil than he excellent in the quality he professes. Besides, divers of worship have reported his uprightness of dealing, which argues his honesty, and his facetious grace in writing, that approves his art.
It is not altogether clear that Chettle is referring to Shakespeare in this passage. Nonetheless, most readers of the passage are swayed by their wishes and choose to believe that Shakespeare is the man in question.
The ultimate significance of Greene's attack to students of Shakespeare is that it establishes the fact that in 1592 Shakespeare was an actor-playwright. It further establishes that by September of 1592 Shakespeare had achieved a prominence sufficient to prompt the attack. One guide to those attempting to establish the exact chronology of Shakespeare's plays is a comment by John Ward, who was vicar of Stratford from 1662 to 1681. Ward's diary for 1661 through 63 includes several remarks about Shakespeare. According to Ward, Shakespeare
supplied the stage with two plays every year.
Although Shakespeare's connection with the theater is vague between 1592 and 1594, there is nothing vague about the publication in 1593 of the first work bearing his name as the author. On the 18th of April, 1593, the poem Venus and Adonis was registered, and the printing by Extract 40 and Richard Field followed later that year. The dedicatory epistle preceding the poem is signed by William Shakespeare. In the epistle, Shakespeare speaks of the poem as the first heir of my invention. It is most likely that the phrase can be taken to mean my first published work. The dedication to the Right Honorable Henry Wriothesley, Earl of Southampton and Baron of Titchfield, is clearly that of a poet in search of a patron.
Right Honorable, I know not how I shall offend in dedicating my unpolished lines to your lordship, nor how the world will censure me for choosing so strong a prop to support so weak a burden. Only if your honor seems but pleased, I account myself highly praised, and vow to take advantage of all idle hours till I have honored you with some graver labor. But if the first heir of my invention prove deformed, I shall be sorry it had so noble a godfather, and never after ear so barren a land for fear it yield me still so bad a harvest. I leave it to your honorable survey, and your honor to your heart's content, which I wish may always answer your own wish and the world's hopeful expectation. Your honors, in all duty, William Shakespeare.
On May 9th, 1594, a book entitled The Ravishment of Lucrece was registered, and The Rape of Lucrece, clearly the graver labor promised in the dedication to Venus and Adonis, was printed by Field later that year. Again, there's a dedication to the Earl of Southampton, now that of a poet who has found a patron.
The love I dedicate to your lordship is without end, whereof this pamphlet without beginning is but a superfluous moiety. The warrant I have of your honorable disposition, not the worth of my untutored lines, makes it assured of acceptance. What I have done is yours. What I have to do is yours, being part in all I have, devoted yours. Were my worth greater, my duty would show greater. Meantime, as it is bound to your lordship, to whom I wish long life, still lengthened with all happiness. Your lordship's in all duty, William Shakespeare.
These two long poems were immensely popular, and a large measure of Shakespeare's fame among his contemporaries rested upon these works. When a modern reader reviews the allusions to Shakespeare made during Shakespeare's lifetime, he's surprised at the high frequency of references to these poems. It seems true that many of Shakespeare's contemporaries considered Venus and Adonis and Lucrece to be more significant literary achievements than his plays. The reason for this curious evaluation is that writing for the stage was widely held to be a low and vulgar occupation, and that stage plays were not to be taken seriously as literature. When Ben Jonson published the folio edition of his own plays in 1616 and called them his works, fellow dramatist Thomas Heywood poked fun at Jonson's presumption. Of special biographical interest to the student of Shakespeare are the dedications to the two long poems. They, along with the argument to Lucrece, are the only surviving non-dramatic prose compositions by Shakespeare. The dedication to Lucrece seems to imply that Southampton had responded to the dedication to Venus and Adonis. An Elizabethan patron was expected to offer financial aid, and Nicholas Rowe offers this account of Southampton's contribution.
He, Shakespeare, had the honor to meet with many great and uncommon marks of favor and friendship from the Earl of Southampton, famous in the histories of that time for his friendship to the unfortunate Earl of Essex. It was to that noble lord that he dedicated his Venus and Adonis. There is one instance so singular in the magnificence of this patron of Shakespeare's that if I had not been assured that the story was handed down by Sir William Davenant, who was probably very well acquainted with his affairs, I should not have ventured to have inserted that my Lord Southampton at one time gave him £1,000 to enable him to go through with a purchase which he heard he had a mind to. A bounty very great and very rare at any time, and almost equal to that profuse generosity the present age has shown to French dancers and Italian eunuchs.
It is most probable that the sum named by Rowe on the authority of Davenant represents a gross exaggeration. All of the known purchases made by Shakespeare during his lifetime do not total £1,000. There is reason to believe that Sir William Davenant was a tall storyteller. The story that Davenant was the illegitimate son of Shakespeare is quite possibly to be accounted for by Davenant's own imagination. There is little reason to doubt, however, that Southampton became Shakespeare's patron, and many believe that a deep friendship developed between the poet and the courtier. Henry Wriothesley, the third Earl of Southampton, was 21 years old in 1593, and had already gained a reputation at court for his grace and accomplishment. There are those who strongly believe that he is the young man addressed by the poet in Shakespeare's sonnets.
An entry in the record of court payments to members of acting companies for March 15, 1595, lists a payment for plays given late in December of 1594 to
William Kemp, William Shakespeare, and Richard Burbage, servants to the Lord Chamberlain.
Since Shakespeare is listed as a payee, there is no doubt that in December of 1594 he was a shareholder in the acting company functioning under the patronage of Henry Lord Hunsdon, the Lord Chamberlain. All records of the company, first known as the Chamberlain's Men and later as the King's Men, indicate that from 1594 until the end of his career, Shakespeare was a principal sharer in this extremely successful company. The license for King's Men, issued on May 19th, 1603, lists 8 shares in the company with Shakespeare's name at the head of the list.
Shakespeare was not only a sharer in the acting company, he became a part owner of the Globe Theatre when it was built in 1599 and a part owner of the Blackfriars in 1608. At one time, scholarship estimated his theatrical income at £700 a year, but more recent research inclines toward a lower figure, roughly £200. Even the lower figure would mean that Shakespeare was well-to-do by the standards of his day.
During these years, Shakespeare maintained residence in London, but he never lost touch with Stratford. He churned out his two plays per year, eternal masterpieces that still, after nearly 400 years, beggar all description. He wrote these plays, all evidence indicates, with the sole object of providing material for his company of actors, and with no thought of publication and no concern for posterity. He wrote a sequence of sonnets, which forms the greatest lyric expression in the language. He performed as an actor for his company, although it's probable that he acted less and less from 1600 on. He purchased houses and land in Stratford, was involved in litigation there, and took some interest in the community life of the town. There is good reason to believe that he frequently made the journey from London to Stratford. There is also reason to believe that there remained time for love and for lust.
You've been listening to This Was a Man. Today, the second program in a 5-part documentary of William Shakespeare's life. The players were Richard Peel as Nicholas Rowe and Robert Greene, Ben Wright as Richard Davies, John Aubrey, and William Shakespeare, William O'Connell as Mr. Dowdle, Donald Freed as The Storyteller, Norman Belkin, Edmund Malone, John Holton, Henry Chettle, and John Ward. This program was based on a research text by John Monteverdi, adapted for radio by Lee Whiting. It was directed and produced by Ruth Hirschman and Lee Whiting with the technical assistance of Michael Dayton. This has been a production of the Drama and Literature Department of Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles.
You have been listening to part two of William Shakespeare, This Was a Man, the 1965 recipient of the Ohio State Award for Broadcast Journalism.